November 15, 1959. Four bodies. A quiet Kansas town that would never sleep soundly again. What happened in the Clutter farmhouse that night wasn't just murder. It was the moment America lost its innocence, when we realized that evil doesn't announce itself with warning signs or logical motives. Sometimes it just arrives at your door, polite and smiling, and destroys everything for $40 and a delusion. This is the story that invented modern true crime, the book that blurred fiction and journalism so completely that we're still trying to untangle them. But more than that, it's a mirror held up to America's face, forcing us to see what we'd rather ignore, that monsters don't always look monstrous, that good people die for no reason, and that sometimes the scariest thing about violence is how utterly meaningless it can be. Herbert Clutter had built something real. At 48, he stood as living proof that hard work and moral character still mattered in America. His 400-acre River Valley farm wasn't just property. It was a testament to Methodist values, early mornings, and the kind of integrity that made neighbors leave their doors unlocked. Square-jawed and college-fit at 154 pounds, Herb had served on Eisenhower's Federal Farm Credit Board. He was the man other men measured themselves against. His family reflected that same wholesome perfection, embodying everything good about small-town American life. Nancy, 16, was the town darling, baking cherry pies for neighbors, practicing clarinet, helping younger girls with their sewing. That Saturday, she'd written about teaching a friend to make pie and watching TV with her boyfriend Bobby. 15-year-old Kenyon worked on a mahogany hope chest for his sister's wedding. Even Bonnie had just received hopeful news that her chronic nervousness might be physical, not mental. That night, as Bonnie placed her reading glasses beside her Bible, marked with a silk bookmark reading, "Take ye heed, watch and pray, for ye know not when the time is," none of them could have imagined those words would become their epitaph. 400 miles away, Richard Hickok and Perry Smith were driving through Kansas darkness toward a fantasy. Hickok had the easy charm of a con man and a car accident face that left his eyes misaligned. Smith was his physical opposite, a powerful upper body on legs so stunted from a motorcycle accident that he lived on aspirin for chronic pain. They'd met in prison, where a former Clutter employee mentioned that the wealthy farmer kept a safe with $10,000 cash. It was a lie. Herb Clutter paid everything by check. What makes their journey chilling is its banality. They stopped for supplies: shotgun, knife, rope, tape. When Perry asked how much rope they needed, Dick calculated. There's him, her, the kid, and the girl. Between these preparations, Perry strummed his guitar and sang hymns. Dick fantasized about a regular life, with a business and plenty of blonde chicken. Evil doesn't always announce itself with darkness and dramatic music. Sometimes it drives through the night, singing church songs, dreaming ordinary dreams, and planning to murder a family for money that doesn't exist. Sunday morning brought perfect pheasant hunting weather and horror. When Nancy Ewalt and her father found no one answering the Clutter door, Nancy fetched Susan Kidwell, Nancy Clutter's best friend. They entered through the unlocked kitchen door because in Holcomb, doors stayed unlocked. The silence felt wrong. Nancy's purse lay open on the floor. Upstairs, Susan opened Nancy's bedroom door and screamed. Blood splattered the wall. Nancy's body on the bed, hands bound, shot point blank in the head. The full scope emerged as authorities searched. Bonnie, in her bedroom, elaborately tied, shot in the head. Kenyon, in the basement, bound and gagged, shot in the face. Herb, in the furnace room, throat cut, face destroyed by shotgun, cord dangling from an overhead pipe, suggesting he'd been suspended and tortured. Four people systematically murdered, and the only sound was a car leaving around 10:30. The murders killed more than the Clutters. They murdered Holcomb's sense of safety. Hardware stores sold out of locks overnight. Families sat up all night with lights blazing. But the real poison was suspicion. Most believed the killer had to be local, someone within 10 miles. Neighbors couldn't look at each other without wondering. "All we've got out here are our friends," one old man observed. "When you can't trust your friends, what's left?" Bobby Rupp, Nancy's boyfriend, and the last person to see the family alive, became the prime suspect before being cleared by polygraph. He and Susan Kidwell spent days driving aimlessly, once watching men search the Clutter property. Susan remembered summer nights riding Nancy's horse Babe in the river while playing flutes, innocent memories now forever contaminated. Violence doesn't just destroy its direct victims, it radiates outward, poisoning memories and entire communities. Holcomb would never again be the place where doors stayed unlocked. KBI agent Alvin Dewey, a fourth-generation Kansan who'd known the Clutters personally, led the investigation with grim determination. "However long it takes, it may be the rest of my life, I'm going to know what happened in that house." The only clues were footprints with diamond-patterned soles and a bloody cat's paw half-sole impression. Despite hundreds of interviews, no suspects emerged. The case cracked open from an unexpected source. Floyd Wells, Hickok's former cellmate, heard about the murders on the radio and realized his casual prison conversation about the wealthy Clutters had sparked this massacre. Wrestling with fear of retaliation, Wells finally told authorities everything. Armed with Wells' information, investigators traced the fugitives through Kansas City, Mexico, where Perry caught a 10-foot sailfish and briefly lived his treasure-hunting fantasy, then back through Texas to Las Vegas. When police spotted their Chevrolet outside a post office on December 30th, the killer's 3,000-mile flight ended quietly. In separate interrogations, both initially denied everything, but when shown photographs matching his boots to crime scene footprints, Hickok broke. "Perry Smith killed the Clutters. I couldn't stop him." Perry's confession revealed the full horror, how they'd searched for a non-existent safe, tied up each family member, even chatted with Nancy about her boyfriend. Most disturbingly, Smith claimed he'd prevented Hickok from raping Nancy. After finding only $40, they methodically murdered everyone to eliminate witnesses. Perry described cutting Herb's throat, then shooting him to end his suffering, a grotesque gesture of mercy from a man committing mass murder. The trial lasted 5 days. Despite defense pleas for psychiatric evaluation, court-appointed doctors briefly interviewed the defendants and found no mental disorders. After 40 minutes of deliberation, the jury returned guilty verdicts and death sentences. As they were led away, Smith said to Hickok, "No chicken-hearted jurors, they." Both laughed loudly, a chilling moment capturing their strange detachment from their crime. Death row became its own torture. For nearly 5 years, Smith and Hickok lived in 7-by-10-foot cells with perpetually burning light bulbs, windows covered in black mesh showing only a dirt lot and slice of sky. An iron door led to the gallows, what prisoners called the corner. Perry felt as though he lived deep underwater in the gray, quiet environment. His mental state deteriorated until he began a 14-week hunger strike, dropping from 168 to 115 pounds. "I just decided that anybody wanted my life wasn't going to get any more help from me." Only a postcard from his estranged father broke his resolve. Their attorneys filed numerous appeals, postponing 3 execution dates and taking the case to the Supreme Court 3 times. All were denied. On April 14, 1965, both men were executed. Hickok went first. "I hold no hard feelings. You're sending me to a better world." Smith followed, acknowledging Agent Dewey with a wink before stating, "I think it's a hell of a thing to take a life in this manner. It would be meaningless to apologize for what I did, even inappropriate. But I do. I apologize." Alvin Dewey expected to feel justice when the killers died. Instead, he found closure the previous year at Valley View Cemetery. While visiting his father's grave, he met Susan Kidwell, now a college junior studying art. Their brief conversation touched on Holcomb, Bobby Rupp's marriage, and the college plans Susan and Nancy had once made together. "I think about it sometimes," Susan said. "Suddenly, when I'm very happy, I think of all the plans we made. As she hurried away, a pretty girl in a hurry, her smooth hair swinging, shining, just such a young woman as Nancy might have been, Dewey understood the real tragedy, not just death, but all the unlived life, the unmade plans, the futures that would never unfold. This story still matters because it reveals uncomfortable truths. Violence is random, safety is fragile, and terrible things happen for no reason. The Clutters weren't killed for who they were, but for what they represented in a fantasy that existed only in damaged minds. We want to believe evil has reasons, that being good keeps us safe. But the Clutters were good. They did everything right. It didn't matter. The question isn't whether we can prevent every tragedy. We can't. It's whether we can hold on to our humanity when such things happen. Can we keep trusting, loving openly, making plans for futures that aren't guaranteed? The Clutters lived fully and built something meaningful before their lives were stolen. Perhaps that's the only victory available, to live as though safety is guaranteed, even knowing it isn't, to make our cherry pies, build our hope chests, and plan our tomorrows despite the darkness that might be driving toward us through the Kansas night.